From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. The H1N1 vaccine launched nationally on Monday, and in much of the media, it was covered like the arrival of the Marines, or the new iPhone, or the Beatles.
We're tracking H1N1.
With 250 million doses of the H1N1 vaccine.
It is here. The first batch of the H1N1 swine flu vaccine has arrived in the city.
But media wouldn't be media without putting on their low, concerned voices to float the sinister what-ifs.
Some medical industry insiders are raising questions about the vaccine safety. So is there a cause for concern?
Right. All right. Now, what do you think of the vaccination?
I have more concern about the vaccine than I do about the swine flu.
HBO's Bill Maher gave his 2 cents when he told his 60,000 Twitter followers they'd be idiots to get the vaccine. Comedian, virologist, and epidemiologist. What a guy. But even if popular fears of widespread lethal side effects are unsupported by science, the fears themselves are very real. A Consumer Reports poll reported that only 34% of those polled said they were definitely planning to get the vaccine. Glenn Nowak is director of media relations at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He says they want to get the media on board to help the CDC fight the misconceptions about the vaccine. Glenn, welcome to OTM.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, I picked on Bill Maher because I thought his tweet was particularly irresponsible. But I dare say there have been much larger audiences for similar messages. Is there any medium or any individual article or broadcast that has been most destructive so far?
Not one that I would single out. It's more along the lines that the media are very obsessed with numbers. And very early on, they wanted to know how many people were infected, how many people were hospitalized, how many people died. And it's really hard to come up with accurate estimates of the number of people who may have been infected with flu. It's not necessary in the vast, vast majority of cases for people to have a test that could indicate whether they actually had flu and what particular strain they had. It's been very challenging in terms of communicating that to the media.
So what does the CDC do to make sure people are getting the straight dope?
Well, I think we're trying to give people the best information possible so that they can make informed decisions. And that includes providing them with information about what are the benefits of vaccination, what are the risks or potential risks associated with vaccination. And in fact, you know, those risks are relatively small. And when it comes to severe outcomes, they're very, very rare. And I think the other thing we've been trying to tell people is that, you know, a decision not to get vaccinated isn't a risk-free decision. It's a decision to take on a different set of risks.
So as we were speaking, I Googled swine flu vaccine. I didn't do H1N1. I just did swine flu vaccine. And the very first result has the following sentence. Dr. Hicks is concerned about the chemicals that get injected into children when they are given a vaccine. Is there anything the CDC can do to combat the misinformation?
One of the things that we do is if you go to the CDC website, you will find user-friendly information that tells you what is in vaccines, what are the ingredients, why are those ingredients there. The reality is that there's millions of blogs out there, millions of websites, and if we undertook efforts to take them on, so to speak, we probably would be giving them more credibility and probably increase the visibility of the messages that we don't believe are true in the first place.
At some point, someone's going to die shortly after having been vaccinated with the H1N1 vaccine. And that will be reported and conclusions will be jumped to. It's my understanding that CDC is trying actually to inoculate itself by giving the media context in advance so they will understand not to overreact and to mistake correlation with causation.
There has been much discussion internally as to how much do you foreshadow and when do you foreshadow specific information. When we talked to some reporters who are interested specifically in vaccine safety, and we said that we know that in the course of a typical week in this country, this many people experience a miscarriage, this many people have a heart attack. Some of those reporters, the first question out of their mouth was, why are you telling me this? There's a concern that when you start talking about those things, are you planting ideas in people's minds? And so are they going to be more likely to believe that the vaccine was associated with those events? We've tried to be transparent throughout, and I think we've decided that we need to provide as much of that information up front, but we are also mindful of the opposite point of view, which is that by putting that information out there, you can create more problems than you solve.
Glenn, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Glenn Nowak is Director of Media Relations for the Centers for Disease Control. Sometimes one heartbreaking incident can threaten to unravel a government's best efforts to educate the public. Since September of 2008, all British girls between the ages of 12 and 18 have been encouraged to get a vaccine that protects against cervical cancer. Last week, fear gripped the country following the tragic death of a 14-year-old named Natalie Morton.
Friends and family have been left devastated after 14-year-old Natalie Morton died suddenly after being given the
cervical cancer. The 14-year-old was vaccinated along with most of her school yesterday. Shortly after having the injection, she turned pale, stopped breathing, and collapsed.
That same week, an autopsy revealed that a previously undiagnosed tumor had killed Natalie, but by then, the damage to the vaccine's reputation was done. Ben Goldacre is a doctor and author of the Bad Science column in the Guardian newspaper. He says reporters have to be especially careful when it comes to a story like this because
health scares are a lot like toothpaste. Once they're out of the tube, they're very, very difficult to get back in.
Now, this story blew up with Natalie's death, but in many ways, the bridge had already been wired for explosives. Papers like the Daily Mail had been on a crusade against the cervical cancer vaccine. And her death seemed to prove that all of their grim predictions were coming to pass.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think there's a strong sense in the UK that in particular the right-wing media use anti-vaccine scares as a kind of rod with which to beat the government's back. There's a very interesting piece of evidence for this. The Daily Mail, which is one of the biggest newspapers in the UK, sells around 2 million copies here, has two editions, one for mainland Britain and one for Ireland. In Britain, the government had paid for the cervical cancer vaccine, so the Daily Mail had a huge campaign against it where they would talk up side effects and they would talk about how dangerous it was. In Ireland, however, the government had refused to fund the cervical cancer vaccine. And in this territory, the Daily Mail's Irish edition was running entirely different stories. They were running a campaign against the government, demanding that the government rolled out the cervical cancer vaccine. And they even had a special campaign logo with the Daily Mail's logo on it saying, "Roll out the vaccine now!" exclamation mark. And to people who know of the Daily Mail in Britain, this is unimaginable. The Daily Mail campaigning for a vaccine. And I think that just, to me, sort of reeks of cynicism and political opportunism.
So comes this girl's death immediately after having been vaccinated. I'm a reporter. I know she's died. I know she's just received the cervical cancer vaccine. What exactly am I supposed to do?
I agree. It's a very, very problematic area for journalists. What you saw, firstly, after this girl tragically died, was people writing stories that were extremely highly suggestive that it was the vaccine that had caused her death. They were writing stories containing things that were just factually incorrect, like saying that the vaccination program had been terminated when it hadn't been. And then even after it was revealed that this girl had died, unfortunately, of a previously undiagnosed fatal cancer, they continued to push an anti-vaccine line. So, for example, there was a front page story in the Daily Express, then followed up in the Daily Mail saying that an American vaccination expert called Diane Harper had said that the vaccine was more dangerous than the cancer it was supposed to protect against. And I've been in touch with Diane Harper, and she says that's not what she thinks at all. And that's what I'm writing about in my column this week. But it's inevitable that girl died probably from cancer vaccination is a much more significant story to the news media than, by the way, you remember that story from a couple of days ago, well, actually, it wasn't the cancer vaccination.
Now, I must say, fear of vaccines is on the list of public policy issues here in the United States, but it's not quite as resonant, it seems to me, as it is in England. Why do you suppose that is?
There's something very interesting about vaccine scares. These are cultural products. They're not about evidence. If vaccine scares were about genuine scientific evidence showing that a vaccine caused a disease, then the vaccine scares would happen all around the world at exactly the same time because information can disseminate itself around the world very rapidly these days. But what you find is that vaccine scares actually respect cultural and national boundaries. So, for example, over the course of the last 10 years in the UK, we had this huge scare that the MMR vaccine causes autism. And this was largely unheard of outside of the UK, although about 10 years after we had it, you seem to be having it. In France, nobody's heard of the idea that the MMR vaccine causes autism, but they have a huge scare that the hepatitis B vaccine causes multiple sclerosis. The most extreme example, of course, is the story of polio vaccine. The World Health Organization were on target to eradicate polio from the face of the globe. But then in Kano province in northern Nigeria, there was a sudden scare that polio vaccine caused infertility. And there was a huge campaign against it there. And the vaccination program failed as a result of that. And Kano province is now a net exporter of polio. So, you know, vaccine scares, I think maybe the media feel that they're quite trivial issues because often the diseases that they protect against, such as measles, are no longer very big killers in the West. But when you take these vaccine scares out of their Western context and put them into a situation where it really matters, the consequence is that people die in very large numbers.
You've made reference to how globally there's something about vaccines that scares people. What is that something?
Vaccination is inherently at odds with modern notions in healthcare of the primacy of choice, that we should all be able to choose our own healthcare interventions, because this is something which, by its nature, has to be taken on by almost the entire population. And I think people resent that. I think in some respects also, it's kind of an act of protest on which people can take a stand. When the MMR vaccine scare really kicked off in the UK in 2002, it was shortly after we were sort of going off to wars that were very, very unpopular. And I think in some respects, people might have felt, well, there's nothing I can do to stop my country bombing, but I can take a stand on vaccines. It almost becomes a kind of poetic response to unrelated problems.
Ben, thank you so much.
Cheers, boss.
Ben Goldacre is a physician and columnist for The Guardian. His column can be found at badscience.net. On Saturday, he weighs in on the cervical cancer vaccine scare. Coming up, scientists cut out the middleman by starting their own wire service, and a hockey team does pretty much the same thing by hiring its very own reporter. This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The last time the words swine flu were prevalent in the news, Gerald Ford was in the White House, and the United States was gearing up to celebrate its bicentennial.
The threat of swine flu outbreak this year is still very, very genuine. Data from the scientific community clearly supports the need for a full-scale inoculation program.
In February of 1976, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare F. David Matthews said, ominously, quote, "The projections are that this virus will kill 1 million Americans." That year, President Ford was vaccinated on television as part of a media photo op and through a series of public service announcements urged all Americans to embrace wide-scale flu shots.
A swine flu epidemic may be coming.
I'm the healthiest 55-year-old you've ever seen. Hey, I play golf every weekend.
Get a shot of protection. The swine flu shot.
Science writer Patrick DiGiusto, who chronicled the 1976 scare in Ceylon, says it all began then with Army Private David Lewis. He was stationed at Fort Dix, New Jersey, set to go on a 50-mile overnight hike with the rest of his platoon when he came down with the flu. But that didn't stop him.
He went on the hike and died. Now, normally 19-year-olds don't die when they have the flu, and this set off a huge panic. And they discovered that the flu that he had was swine flu, somewhat similar to the flu that wiped out a good portion of the world in 1918.
Now, your piece in Ceylon documented a convergence of a number of factors. One of them was the death of this army private. Another was politics in the Republican Party as President Ford tried to get the nomination for a next run at the presidency.
California Governor Ronald Reagan put up a spirited fight against Ford. It came to a head on March 23, 1976, when Reagan won the North Carolina primary. President Ford, the very next day, gathered together the nation's top immunologists and held a press conference about how he was going to save the country against the coming plague.
And if that weren't a fertile enough environment for overreaction, came the deaths of several American Legionnaires in Philadelphia. How did that play into the panic?
Between March, when the news about swine flu really reached the public, and August, the scientists really started to calm down. They had analyzed the disease that killed Private Lewis a lot better, and they realized that it probably was not going to be a 1918-style pandemic. Then the Legionnaires' disease happened. Immediately, almost every media outlet covering this saw death. The New York Post first headline was, "Killer fever, 21 dead, 134 ill." The very next day, two more deaths. Mortality rate hits 22%. Now, the original Spanish flu in 1918 had a 2.5% mortality rate. Here they're screaming that the mortality rate of this disease is 10 times higher. A few days later, the New York Post calmed down and its headline read, "Killer fever, it's not flu."
Now, your piece goes into some exquisite detail describing the politics in Congress over what happened after the Legionnaires' disease and an on-again, off-again, on-again national inoculation program. But to make a long story short, Congress did authorize such a program, and virtually every American was to get an anti-flu vaccine for free. And then what happened?
The flu program started on October 1st. It went well. People were lining up, were getting immunized as they should. And then on the night of October 11th in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, three elderly people died within a few hours of getting their flu shot. Mass media panic once again.
Now, this turned out to be a classic example of correlation, not necessarily implying causation.
Exactly.
You described the media freak out, but there was one voice of calm and reason, and that was
Walter Cronkite. The CDC had pointed out that throughout this immunization campaign, there will be coincidences. Someone who was going to have a heart attack that day will get the flu shot and then have their heart attack, and it'll be almost impossible to stop people from connecting the two. When all this happened, Walter Cronkite came on and gave one of his rare commentaries where he actually spanked his media colleagues a bit, telling them that this was not the way they should be behaving.
Now, let's bring this back to 2009. It seems to me that the press itself has been fairly responsible in the coverage so far. Do you agree?
Well, not entirely. I mean, I've seen people out there asking, and it's always done in the form of a question, "Is this the new Black Death?" I mean, I've actually heard that.
All that in news, weather, and sports after this.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Patrick DeGiusto is a science writer based in New York City. We first aired this piece in May of this year. Here's how lay people used to find out about a new scientific advancement. A scientist made a discovery. The PR department at the scientist's university issued a press release summarizing the findings. That press release would be mailed to the science reporters of various media outlets. Good science journalists would receive those releases and try to figure out if the story was indeed newsworthy, and if so, then to contextualize the findings, all through the filter of basic journalistic skepticism. Mediocre science journalists would just rewrite the press release. Of course, all this was way back when media companies could afford to have trained science correspondents. As papers downsize, their science sections are often among the first places to be gutted. This year, the Boston Globe earned the dubious honor of being one of the most prominent newspapers to dissolve its science section. In television, CNN did the same last December. In this new environment, where media coverage of science is sparser and sparser and tends to veer more towards the rewrite the press release school of reportage, perhaps it's no surprise that some research universities have decided to bypass journalists altogether. That's the idea behind Futurity.org, a new website which lets universities release word of their scientific findings directly to the audience without stopping for a journalistic middleman. We spoke with Mike Schoenfeld, Vice President for Public Affairs and Government Relations at Duke University and one of the co-founders of the site. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bob.
I could conduct this interview in two ways, one skeptical and one so grateful. So I'll do both. Let's start with skeptical. When we lose the journalism part of the reporting cycle on science, don't we lose the skepticism and the arm's length relationship that we need to trust that which we are reading?
The short answer is yes, of course. That, unfortunately, has happened in all too many ways and in all too many places. What Futurity is doing doesn't diminish the ability of journalists to be skeptical, to be appropriately thorough in vetting the kind of information that comes out of our institutions. It just provides another channel.
You actually could have given me a third response, which has to do with the dubious quality of some of the science journalism that we're losing. For now, let me just say what I miss on the Futurity website is, you know, a prominent disclaimer that says this is a PR newswire. It has not been mediated by anyone like a journalist. It's direct from the public relations offices of the universities where the science is originating. Couldn't you put that on there just to make things exquisitely clear?
Well, I think that's a bit dramatic, if I do say so myself. First of all, the site does say news from leading research universities. Second, I think it's pretty clear in both the datelines and in the content as you're reading this that this is information that's coming directly from the source. Most of the content on Futurity comes from the very same people who, until a short time ago, were reporting these stories for the major news media. And I dare say that the principal investigators, the researchers, the scholars who are producing this are pretty rigorous themselves before it ever goes out the door.
The problem, of course, is the circumstances when they aren't and when some skepticism should be taking place, when some eyebrows should be raised, and this mechanism doesn't really provide for that, does it?
Well, what this mechanism does provide is direct access to information. The internet is the great leveler here, and people have the ability to seek out primary information directly from sources, whether it's politics or government or history or entertainment or science. So we're offering an opportunity to get access to this information in a convenient, easy-to-use place.
Okay, so let me do what I promised and now conduct the second part of the interview, which begins with, thank goodness, because at least, at a very minimum, Futurity does not fall prey to the temptations for oversimplification and overhype that so riddles the mainstream media's coverage of health and science issues and has for such a long time. These things are quite straightforward, and very few of the cancer cure question mark kind of headlines that we've come to expect. So I guess that, in the first instance, is pretty good.
And that is very much a conscious decision. We are not interested in breakthroughs, in miracle cures, in saving the world discovery headlines that you can get in much of the news media that covers this. I would hope anybody who is coming to Futurity is also doing the things that you should be doing to become science and research literate. You're reading Science Times in the New York Times. You're reading Scientific American. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. That is absolutely essential to get a full picture. If this is the only place that people get science, then we're in bigger trouble than we think.
Finally, let's just say that the traditional media's coverage of science and health issues continues to plummet with the collapse of the media structures that have underwritten this kind of work for a couple of centuries. And futurity and its like become more and more important. How do you resist the temptation to lead with the sexiest, you know, most populistic stories, and in fact to exaggerate their importance in exactly the way that the media have for so long?
At one level, I would say we should be so lucky to have such influence. But really, the more direct answer is that our names are attached to this. Our names as research institutions, as creators of new knowledge, as educational institutions, that's a pretty valuable currency for us. So there will always be enough checks and balances, I'm confident, in the process.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Mike Schoenfeld is one of Futurity's co-founders and Vice President for Public Affairs and Government Relations at Duke University. On the subject of skipping the middleman, consider the Los Angeles Kings. It's a professional hockey team, not a very successful one. Not only do the Kings often lose in on-ice competition, they have a hard time in the competition for media coverage in a market with the champion Lakers, the champion Dodgers, the champion Angels, and college football powerhouses USC and UCLA. The Kings lose out so often, in fact, that they have decided to take their media destiny into their own hands by hiring veteran sports reporter Rich Hammond, who until recently covered the Kings for the LA Daily News. That's right, Hammond will now be a full-time Kings reporter whose stories will appear on the Kings website and whose salary will be paid by the Kings. This arrangement has some wondering, first, how Hammond can possibly remain objective, and second, whether this is at least one future of journalism. Rich Hammond joins me now. Hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
If someone had said to you 5 years ago that you were going to be covering the Kings in the employ of the Kings, what would you have said?
No, I would not have believed it. Frankly, I wouldn't even have believed it 1 year ago. You know, it's not something that a team has really done before, and it's a concept that kind of evolved over the past 6 months, kind of started as a theoretical question or a conversation and got more real the more that we discussed it. So no, I certainly did not ever anticipate being able to do something like this.
Okay, so when you consider that he who pays the piper calls the tune, are you not in public relations? Are you still a journalist? What exactly beast are you now?
Right. They have hired me with the authority to be a journalist, to do the exact same job that I've always done. The thing that makes this work, I think, is that I already have a body of work. I've covered the team at least on a part-time basis or full-time basis for about 8 years now. So they've been able to look at the kind of writer that I am and decide whether or not they were comfortable with some of the things that were going to be reported and put on their website that they were going to be paying for, frankly. And I've been doing this now for 1 week. Haven't heard a peep out of anybody and don't anticipate doing so.
If Pfizer or AstraZeneca took the LA Daily News healthcare reporter and employed them to try to cover healthcare on their blogs,
right,
there's nobody who would call that journalism. That would be absolutely deemed public relations. If General Dynamics hired somebody, the LA Times defense reporter, to cover the Pentagon, that would be unambiguous as well. Just explain for me why covering a hockey team is different.
I report on things on games that are seen by thousands and millions of people. If I'm trying to hide anything or downplay stories, it's all going to be out there in the public, and this isn't going to work. For there to be some type of change in tone or change in coverage, somebody has to be motivated for it not to work, and I don't think either side is. We started with the understanding that it was going to be independent. If there wasn't that understanding to begin with, there wouldn't have been any need for further conversation.
Understanding, underschmanding. Do you have a contractual guarantee?
Yes. Yeah.
I can see how this might be confusing to readers.
Yeah.
I can also see how it could be confusing to players who are talking to a fellow employee and may think that they have some sort of impunity that they don't necessarily have.
That's right.
Has anything changed in the relationship? And have you had to caution them that, listen, you're still on duty, so just what?
That's a very good point. That was my first concern, is how the players are going to react, because those are the guys that I have to spend the most time around. So what I did is the first 2 days I sat down with the captain of the team and one of the assistant captains, and just said, hey, the relationship with me doesn't change. Obviously, I'm going to be around more. I'm going to be on the road when I normally wouldn't have been on the road, but I'm not going to have any more access than I normally had. When the newspaper reporters leave the locker room, I leave the locker room. I'm not hanging around there 5 minutes before the game. I'm not in there between periods. So that comfort level is going to remain exactly the same. They know if we have off-the-record conversations, they're still off-the-record.
How are things in the press box?
I now sit one seat to the right where I used to sit. So that's been the major change. The angle on the TV is a little different, and I take a lot of ribbing from the writers, but it's all very good-natured ribbing. You know what? When you talk about journalists, and I've been in this profession for almost 15 years now, if people weren't skeptical, I'd be disappointed in them. We should be looking at this critically, but you know, all I've said to anybody, whether it's colleagues or readers, just give it a read. The proof is going to be in the product, and if you read it for a while and you think it works, then I hope you'll continue reading.
Well, Rich, thank you very much.
Okay, my pleasure, guys. Thank you.
Rich Hammond covers the Los Angeles Kings hockey team for the Los Angeles Kings hockey team. Coming up, have you ever wondered why product reviews online are so nice? Stay tuned for the answer. This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Was a time when copy editors were prized for their ability to write punchy headlines that fit snug as a bug into the space allotted. Punchiness, alas, is less and less in demand because wordplay does not impress search engines. Hence, a new figure in the modern-day newsroom, the Search Engine Optimizer, or SEO. Brent Payne is the director of search engine optimization for Tribune Interactive, part of the Tribune Company. He advises headline writers to check their punch at the door.
If you're writing a story about Michael Jackson dying, make sure you put Michael Jackson dead somewhere in your headline. Don't go with Wacko Jacko or King of Pop. And that helps Google to figure out that, oh, that's what this story is about.
The point of all of this is to generate the greatest possible traffic, even if it means diverting traffic from, say, the Chicago Tribune to the L.A. Times at the expense of, let's say, the Tribune reporters' labors.
We struggle with this a lot, actually. We had to make a decision who should be the destination for this if we have any chance of getting to the front page of Google. Because 70% of people don't go past that first page when they do a query inside of Google. And thus, it's better to be on the front page with one of the Tribune properties than to be on the second, third, or fourth page with several Tribune properties.
So how does this go over in the newsroom where you're essentially funneling traffic away from one property to another or kibitzing the headline writers? Can the newsroom stand this?
I'm not saying that 100% of the people are on board all the time. Usually, if it's an LA fire story, it's not that difficult to get people to link to the Los Angeles Times. If there's a hurricane hitting Florida, it's pretty clear that it's either going to be the Sun Sentinel or the Orlando Sentinel that's going to be the ultimate destination for the story. But when you have situations like, you know, Michael Jackson dead, well, that's where we do have some struggles. And keep in mind that the breaking news only lasts for 3 or 4 hours. It's a huge spike in traffic. And there's a lot of competition that we try and focus it to one destination.
Apart from affecting the way headlines read, do you have any other influence in the newsroom in terms of how to maximize traffic online? What kind of stories to cover? What stories do the best in Google News?
So what I mentioned to the editorial staff is that Google Trends is a huge tool to figure out what people are searching for right now. It tells anybody who uses the tool the top 40 searches that are going on this hour. And if there are stories or angles that we have that we could help to cover some of those, I absolutely encourage the editorial staff to take a look at that. Now, some people ask who's running the show here. Is it the searchers that influence what the media is going to cover, or is it the media writing the stories that the searchers will be interested in? And I'd say both. I'd say that in some scenarios, such as great feature articles, it starts with the press. But in other situations where a huge event occurs and people are looking for a certain search phrase, well, then perhaps we would have more coverage than we would have normally had we not noticed on Google Trends or other places that a lot of people were interested in it.
But isn't that just an invitation to pander to the most populistic tastes? I mean, Michael Jackson's death, which we've discussed quite a bit, may have been the biggest story in the news for days, but not because it has a whole lot of significance in the overall scheme of things.
I would say that who are we to say what is or isn't important? Gmail being down was a huge thing a few days ago. Is that important to the human race? Well, I think that you could argue both ways. Why is it our call to determine what is or isn't important to the audience?
Because that's our call, to determine what is and is important to the audience. I mean, isn't that what journalism is substantially? Not just the ability to root out information, but the judgment to know what is more important than other things?
Right. And now we have a bunch of information to tell us what people think is interesting or significant. It's not a one-way communication anymore. It's not like it was 100 years ago where we can just stand up on a soapbox somewhere and deliver the news and that's it.
That said, journalism is still about professional judgment. And when so many advertising dollars are riding on where traffic goes, how do you avoid sliding unrestrained down the slippery slope of pandering to popular tastes as opposed to being true to your professional judgment?
You have ingrained in every journalist a certain mindset. You have the editors that are in charge of not only online but print as well that have had years of experience in journalism. And all I'm doing is helping them find opportunities to drive additional traffic if there's reasonable content for it. So I think that balance is pretty significant when you have hundreds of journalists versus a small team of SEO people.
Brent, I very much appreciate your stopping by.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Brent Payne is Director of Search Engine Optimization for Tribune Interactive. This week, the Federal Trade Commission issued new guidelines for bloggers, tweeters, Facebookers, and anyone else who regularly posts comments or reviews on the internet. Beware, if you endorse a product and are in any way compensated for your kind words, you must, quote, clearly and conspicuously reveal the nature of your payment. In other words, tell everyone if you're shilling. Sounds reasonable, but many online are crying foul, pointing out that these rules don't apply to traditional news organizations. So does the FTC, in effect, have a double standard? Is online speech now overly and unfairly regulated, as some claim? Andy Cernovitz is author of Word of Mouth Marketing and a blogger at damniwish.com. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Before we get to the reservations some have voiced about the new regulation, let's talk about what's good about it. It's kind of sleazy out there, is it not?
There's a lot of sleaze and there's a lot of overeagerness. You know, everyone's so excited to suddenly be writing and have an audience that we all want to be a part of the story. So when a company comes to us and says, hey, talk about my stuff, people do it. And we forget that there's this trust. You know, someone's reading your blog, your buddies are reading your Facebook page, and they're not expecting you to be getting corporate products and promotions and samples. And suddenly that gray area comes up. Is this a journalist? Is this your friend? Are they paid? Are they volunteering?
Kind of like being invited to dinner at a friend's house and thinking it's a social engagement and discovering after dessert they're getting out the easel and drawing circles and trying to get you an Amway.
If you're going to a friend's house for a Tupperware party, you know you're going for a commercial event. If you show up for fun and they start selling to you, this is very uncomfortable.
I guess in that sense, you're applauding these new regulations.
Yeah, this is great news for consumers, this is great news for bloggers, and this is great news for marketers, because we finally understand what the rules are. The FTC gave us simple checklist. If you take one free sample one time, no problem. But if you have a long-term relationship with a marketer, so you're taking samples from them all the time, you have to disclose. If you sign up for a word-of-mouth marketing program that's purpose is to give you samples to talk about, you have to disclose. If you take money, you have to disclose. If you do these handful of things, you're no longer just blogging for yourself. You're now a paid endorser. So if you say, Sony sent me this stereo, and here's what I think about it, that phrase, Sony sent me the stereo, you've done your job, and everybody's clear, and everybody's protected.
So here's the problem. If you apply the same regulations against traditional media, a lot of what newspapers and other news organizations have been doing for so long would suddenly require disclosure. Like if you review a book, you've probably gotten the book in the mail from the publisher. Same with CDs and movie reviews. Are newspapers now responsible to put the same disclaimers on their stories as bloggers are now obliged to do?
What they're saying is now bloggers are held to the same obligation as journalists always were held to. Now, with journalists, you have less risk of confusion. If I'm a book reviewer for a newspaper or I'm the auto reporter for a newspaper, people know I didn't buy the books or the cars, and people understand that's my job. But if it's a personal blog, people assume you don't get free stuff from companies, and that's where the danger of confusion is. So the FTC has said it's a level playing field. If people want to write about products, they have to go by the same ethical obligations as a journalist, and the obligation isn't specifically disclosure. It's making sure nobody gets deceived. Does the average reader understand what's going on? So when you read Walt Mossberg or David Pogue, you know it's their job to review products.
Walt Mossberg in the Wall Street Journal, David Pogue in the New York Times, both Gizmo columnists.
There's no chance of consumer confusion that Walt is running around buying computers all day, 20 a week. No confusion there. With a person, an individual who suddenly starts talking about a computer on their Facebook page, the average consumer would be deceived. So the simple standard that applies to everybody, which is if you are writing something and you're working for a marketer, you're getting something free, you're getting paid, you've chosen to engage with a marketer, you have to be straight with folks.
Well, I'll tell you, Andy, one nice bonus that might come of this is more disclosure from the traditional media for the car reviewer to say, by the way, I've been driving around in this Cadillac or Mercedes or Lexus for the last 10 days at the car maker's expense. That can't hurt, can it?
It's awesome. I mean, 10 years ago, if a reporter started taking samples and freebies and trips, they'd be fired. We've forgotten how it used to be. We forgot what the most basic standard of journalistic ethics are regarding gifts and samples. And if this pushes us to have that conversation again, if this pushes us to raise the bar, we all win.
All right, Andy. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bob.
Andy Cernovitz is the author of Word of Mouth Marketing. One irony about the sleazy practice of buying favorable reviews is that it may not even be remotely necessary. While bloggers and online commentators have an ugly tendency to say the meanest, sometimes most libelous things about people, when it comes to product and service ratings online, the blogosphere is too nice. As the Wall Street Journal recently observed, online rating sites are like Lake Wobegon. Everyone is above average. For instance, at Amazon.com, Johnson & Johnson cotton balls get 5 out of 5 stars. Mighty Bright replacement bulbs, mostly 5-star reviews there, too. Almond cookies, 5 stars. A box of individual Splenda packets, a vicious group of irate consumers slammed it with 4.5 stars. But all the love is actually kind of a problem for the companies who make the rating software, for the companies whose products are reviewed, and for people who rely on reviews to help to figure out what to buy. Jeffrey Fowler is a San Francisco-based reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He wrote about the phenomenon and says it's a little-known fact about the internet.
We tend to think of the internet as a place filled with mean blogs about celebrities and email flame wars. But there is, in fact, this growing corner of the web where people have a problem that they tend to be just too positive. When you give people the option between 1-star and 5-star, most things average out to about 4.3. And some particular categories of products tend to average even higher. Like if you look at the average ratings for dog food, that's like a 4.8.
Okay, so is this a function of human nature? What do you suppose makes someone put in a rating for a dog food or, as you noted in your piece, printer paper? Printer paper?
Yes, those are among the most popular things to review online. The answer is you'd be surprised. The more you see yourself as an expert in something, the more likely you are to give a positive review because that proves that you make smart choices, that you know how to pick the best restaurant or you know how to select the best dog food. And that's what some research from the University of Toronto found. Specifically in that study, they found that people generally gave negative reviews at the same rate, but people who thought of themselves as experts in topics were way more inclined to give positive reviews.
I guess it's nice to live in a world, a beautiful place where people really love their printer paper. But is this a problem in any way?
Yes. And many of the sites will say, you know, the ratings, they're just a starting point. What really matters is the content of the reviews. That's true, but it's a little bit like saying, doesn't matter what the headlines are on newspaper stories. It's only that what's in the stories. Okay, but you got to read the headlines first. So it does cause a problem. And some sites are actually taking some steps to deal with it. A company that was one of the first to deal with this problem was eBay. It used to be that eBay would judge the quality of its sellers based on the average rating. But the ratings were so high that it had to set 4.3 as a baseline. If you fell underneath 4.3, you were an unacceptable eBay seller. So what they did recently is they changed that system, and now they're just counting the numbers of 1- and 2-star reviews. That way, they can see just when it's really just a terrible experience.
But then isn't it a whole lot easier for some malicious party to torpedo an otherwise perfectly agreeable seller just because he is in the mood to do so?
eBay sellers argue with the company about that all the time. Other companies are dealing with this problem by just trying to find different ways to measure quality. Let's take YouTube, for example. They put out a blog post 2 weeks ago announcing their 5-star dilemma, saying that most people were only leaving 5-star reviews. And they, you know, put out a call. They said, what other ways can we use information in a better way? Well, they could just measure how often people actually finish watching videos or how often people like a video so much that they share it with their friends on Facebook or other social networks.
Has anyone been able to quantify what portion of this aggregated kindness is attributable to people trying to game the system, essentially praise fraud?
The companies that run these sites say that this does happen. Earlier this year, the website TripAdvisor, which rates hotels and vacation destinations, did have to put up a notice saying that some of the reviews of hotels on their site could have been left by hotel managers. But on the aggregate, these sites say that that actually doesn't happen too often. And some of them actually pay staff to go through and delete things that were obvious puffery.
Okay, so I have some questions about a digital camera or a quart of milk or printer paper. And I go on to whatever the review site is, and everything is 4.3 or above. How in the world am I supposed to come up with any kind of judgment? What have I learned?
Just to underscore that even more, there was a recent study by Nielsen, and they asked people which forms of media they tend to trust the most. And near the very top of the list, 72% of Americans said that they trust online reviews. Some of the companies that use these rating systems say it's actually a self-selecting world. So if you find a good printer paper and you give it a good review, other people are going to go to the site and find that printer paper and choose to buy it. And they're also going to find it to be good, and they're going to leave more positive reviews. So good products encourage more good reviews. And bad products, ones that get bad ratings, people stop buying. And in the best case scenario, they're taken off the market. And the companies learn a lesson.
Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jeffrey Fowler is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hey, Mike. Our producer, Mike Volo. Hey, Mike, give me some things to rate. We'll see if this guy's right.
Just anything?
Yeah. Name like 8 things and I'll rate them. 0 to 5. You tabulate.
All right. Let's see. A sunset.
5.
The Bill of Rights.
5.
Mahler's Second.
5.
Store brand canned gravy.
5.
Ernest Saves Christmas.
5.
Vladimir Putin.
5.
The American League.
0.
Diphtheria.
5. Is that all 8 of them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I'll read the credits. You figure out the average. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Hauver and Dan Mazzi, and edited by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield. Mike, you got a number for me?
You're not going to believe it. A little over 4.3.
4.3. Amazing.
Amazing.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.